I'll tell you something I love about being in France, in addition to some seriously delicious butter, and that is the wide selection of wines I can find in France for low prices. It can be much more difficult to source those same bottles back in the States, and that's why I love to buy wines out of France with Ideal Wine. I have bottles shipped to me, hassle-free. It's easy. Ideal Wine has a new auction every week and is a great source for iconic names like Ouette, Louis Roeder, and Domaine Lefleuve, as well as rising stars like Arnaud Lachaud, Gonon, and Tissot. Find the wines you'd rather be drinking at idealwine.com. That's IDEALWINE.com and have the wine shipped to you in the States. Use the promo code FIRST, FIRST, for $15 off your first order of $150 or more. Hey, that's $15 you could save, and that is some good butter money. See for yourself at Ideal Wine.
I'll Drink to That, where we get behind the scenes of the beverage business. I'm Levy Dalton.
I'm Erin Scala.
And here's our show today.
George Skouras of Skouras from the Peloponnese in Greece on the show today. Hello, sir. How are you?
Very exciting to be with you.
Very nice to see you. So about 40 years ago, you were in France studying how to make wine.
Exactly. That was like the end of the 70s. And I went there to exactly to do things, you know, to have some studies in chemistry, things like that. But I became a guy who was involved with wine.
And how did that happen? I mean, what occurred to change your mind?
Oh, that's a beautiful story. That I was in Aix-en-Provence, and I had time. That was just some days, just to learn French and to decide what to do. And a friend of mine, a professor of Greek letters, asked me to go with him to go on excursion. You know, so we took a car and we went to Montpellier, Languedoc, you know, and it was like a discovery to me. I was with this small car, a Peugeot 204, and it was like a tour to be in a sea of vineyards. I was amazing. And then we arrived to a small chateau. And then a couple of some friends of him, a nice couple. It is like a film. They waited us in the front of the chateau behind a nice iron door. And then they opened the door with all these noises, you know, the doors doing. And after the door, it was the apocalypse for me. Because that was a winery. That was a chateau with a winery and vineyard. And as I was the young guys, these guys, they took me by the hand and they started to show to me how the vineyards are and then what it is, the wine. See all the facilities, the cellars and everything. Then when lunch started, we never stopped. We went until dinner because they were so grateful to me to start to ask me, you know, what is the age of your father? Aha, this year, 1929, it was marvelous. Let's pick a bottle of that. What is that? And what is that? And what is that? And I was amazing, really amazing. And then after that, I had no possibility to speak and to, you know, I was speechless, like I had to see something, the best theater in my life. And 2 days later, when I arrived in the university, I went to the secretary and I started to see something with wine. And I saw the word enology. Enology, which is enologia, that's a Greek word. And I said, that's me. I'll do that.
And you'd grown up in Greece or?
I'm coming from Peloponnese, from a city in Peloponnese called Argos, which is next to Nemea. I had nothing to do with wine. I had a lot to do with commerce because my father was in the commerce and with a beautiful épicerie. And I learned from him a lot. I learned from him to be, you know, correct with the people, to give to the people right things, good things, and to respect everything in the business. I finished my school in Greece, and 18 years old, I went in France for having studies. And 19 years old, I started to do the wine business.
How long were you in France?
5 years. You know, this I told you about this professor. So this professor was one of my five mentors. Why? Because he called another professor in the University of Dijon, Mr. Bergeret. He called him and he told that, you know, there's a guy, Greek, he want to be an enologist. Mr. Bergeret was one of the professors, you know, of the guys that started everything about enology and science of enology in Dijon. And he asked me, okay, George, you want to really you wanted to know about the wine and winemaking? Yes. Okay, look at that. There's a big problem. Because, you know, when you will go to the university with your other guys there, you will see that everyone from them, they come from families, they are winemakers, they have vineyards, they do, yeah. And when I'm speaking and say, like, I take the pipe and I do a remote pump over, you will understand nothing. So you need to work in the French vineyard. And yes, that I did. 5 years, I didn't take a break. I was working all over in Alsace, in Champagne, in France, all over France. I mean, Burgundy, Beaujolais, all over. And I did everything. I did from nothing to everything. And that was my greatest school, because like that, I became one of them. And that was, you know, for all my life, it was the biggest possibility to see the world of the wine. And I was in love of the wine. That means passion.
When you think about what was happening in Greece in the late 70s.
Yeah, late 70s in Greece, the wine was nothing. When I came back, it was like 83. And I started to work for a company at Kefalonia. It was like 70 wineries all over Greece. That's all. But in the meantime, people like me, without knowing each other, you know, famous people now, Mr. Yuri Vasiliou, Mr. Telepos, Yannis Paraskevopoulos, Parasigalas, you know, all these guys. We were in the same time having studies in France, in Italy, in California. And then we came back. And then we started working in several wineries. And then we started our thing. And then we met each other. That was the best. And that was the most nice thing happened to the Greek wine. Because when we met each other, we put together a beautiful federation. And we started to connect, you know, each other and speaking about that and understand that we have to do a lot of things and organize our trips and exports and, you know. But it was hard times. So when I went in Kefalonia, I was there and I work on the Caligas, it is not anymore, Caligas winery. Especially doing a lot of wines from Kefalonia, you know, the Robola stuff, Mavro Daphne, and a lot of other local varieties. It was something very important for me because it was another life to see some other things. I knew nothing about Greek varieties, nothing about Greek varieties. And it was a very nice moment to discover everything and to do some good things. And suddenly there, I met a guy, Spiros Kosmetatos, a strange guy, who wanted to make wine. So I went to see him in his house, and I found him with some, you know, some small dummies in which there was a juice of grapes, like kits, you know, and some yeast, and trying to do wine like that. I said, okay, this is not how we make the wine. And we started to work together. He already planted some vineyards, and we create a whole winery from nothing. This guy was another mentor for me. It was the guy who taught me how to do everything with nothing. It is always something to put in the mind that I have to do that, and then to prepare how to do that, you know. And that was, we create this beautiful Gentilini vineyard, Gentilini winery. It was a wine white. This wine was like, if I remember, much, much more expensive than every other Greek wine. And that worked. People loved the wine. We started to have beautiful vintages together, harvest together. And that works very, very, very much.
Kefalonia is an island, and there had been a large earthquake in the 50s. And so what was it like for you when you were there?
Kefalonia, when I've been there, it was an island after the earthquakes, as you say. And it was practically without people in the island, because after the earthquakes, a lot of people went out of Kefalonia having other business all over, you know, United States or I don't know where. So Kefalonia, it was for me like El Dorado, you know. It was like, oh, what? There is so beautiful things to do here. Argostoli was a town with 1,500 people, which now it is more than 12,000 people. And, you know, it was really a lot of abandoned vineyards. And it was a big challenge to me to see and walk all with all these people. And because people, they had a beautiful culture about wine and winemaking. Kefalonia was very famous from the 18th century, because in Kefalonia, there was the famous vinaries, and vinaries was wineries. And a lot of ships came there and took some beautiful wines, especially from Mavro Daphne and Moscato sweet wines. Because also, Kefalonia, it is an island in which there was a lot of Venetians. It was under occupation of Venetians in the times. So there was all this beautiful, you know, culture about wine, sweet wines and everything. Yeah. And of course, very beautiful vineyards too.
Spiros Kosmatatos, where was he coming from? What was his background that he decided to make wine in Kefalonia when there was very, very few wineries there?
Spiros Kosmatatos was a guy who lived in United Kingdom, and he decided to be winemaker. And first, he decided to be winemaker in United Kingdom, and he tried to buy, unbelievable, seventies, and he tried to buy land there, if I remember well. But as he was from Kefalonia, he came back, and because he had some land and everything, he starts to do some things there. And also, there's a book. He wrote a book about that, because it was a real unbelievable moment to be two people together and other guys together with us, and to set up a brand new winery, really excellent with, you know, everything.
But he kind of also taught you how to kind of start with no money.
Yes, you know, money, it is something, money, you can find money. It's not yours, but you can find money. The thing is, and Spiros Kosmatatos taught me something, the scenarios. So it was, first of all, the scenario of success. And you do your best and you have success. That's the good scenario. Okay. And then another scenario, the scenario which is already success, you see. That means that you start, everything is okay, but you have to do more and more and more to be really successful. Another scenario which was very important for me, the scenario of destroy everything. And what to do, how to think about that scenario to don't go to the jail because you own money and because I don't know what. So these three scenarios, it was a very, very important. It was something which helped me a lot.
As a young person, Spiros Kosmatatos taught you that there was open possibility that you could kind of set your own thing. And even if you weren't well-funded, you could start a winery and find the material in this land where there weren't a lot of people working with wine, even though historically there had been a long tradition. And he also kind of put some goalposts out for you to think about long-term, what kind of future you wanted to have.
Yes, 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 of course, yes. As you put that, yeah. Absolutely. But, you know, also Spiros Kosmatatos showed to me the possibility to do things, to be other than enologist and winemaker, to be a human being having a lot of different ways of thinking, and, you know, to be also businessman, which is another thing, because, after all, it is something.
That must have been... take some, in a way, either foresight or courage to price a white wine from Kefalonia as high as that Robola that you released was. So what was the thinking there? Because it ended up being a success, but, you know, it was much more pricey than the neighboring wines at the time.
Yeah, it was like that. Yeah, it was like that. But a guy in Athens, Vangelis, adopt our, he was in the wine business, adopt our, you know, our efforts. And, you know, we had all these high costs. It was unbelievable. The cost, it was something very high. And he says, okay, don't worry. We will put it in the market. And because it is the highest price existing in the market, it will work. And it worked, you know. And I remember it was a lot of people who tasted that wine and was, you know, so clean style, beautiful acidity, crispy, you know, acidity. It was in the time, at the time, something very difficult to understand because the most of the people, they did the harvest at 13, 14, I don't know what, 15 degrees of alcohol. And we had like 11.5 or 12. And of course, crispy acidities and crispy fruits, and that helped a lot, and people liked the wine, and that's all.
It was a clean, fresh, modern expression, which was a new thing for Greece.
Yeah, I think it is a style. Greece has all these beautiful mountains and, you know, the islands and the climate. It is unbelievable. The freshness of the grapes existing there and the health of the grapes also. And that helps a lot to have crispy fruit and, of course, having a nice wine after that. Because, after all, what is a wine? It is an excellent fruit, which the juice of which become a wine. And if you have a healthy fruity fruit, and if you do what we have to do, then the wine will be amazing.
No one had really come in to do a clean, crisper style yet, and you kind of pioneered that in Kefalonia.
Yeah, that was, we did, without knowing what exactly we did.
When we come back from the break, George Skouros makes a decisive move.
You returned to where you grew up, you went back to Nemea.
That's coming up right after this. I talk to winemakers all the time, and something they tell me is that oxygen management is a key to aging wine. Finding the right balance is crucial, and that's why I recommend DM's revolutionary cork closures. With DM corks, winemakers can achieve precisely controlled oxygen management after a bottle leaves the winery, ensuring a wine that matures gracefully and reaches its full potential. With over 2 billion DM corks sold each year, it's clear that winemakers worldwide trust DM for consistent results. And DM has recently expanded the permeability options for their popular DM10 and DM30 closures, providing winemakers with even more flexibility to choose a cork that will guarantee the kind of wine life they envision. Banish surprise dud bottles and embrace DM closures. your customers will thank you. In North America, DM products are exclusively distributed by G3 Enterprises. Ready to ensure the lifespan of your wines? Go to dm-closures.com/IDTT to learn more. That's DIAM-closures.com/IDTT for more information.
Then you decided to do kind of what Spiros did. You returned to where you grew up. You went back to Nemea.
Yeah, actually with Spiros, we created another kind of business like a wine club, because we found that there was a lot of people who loved the wine and who had to have a like a club and something like that. So we created this club, but I'm not the best for manage that. So I took the challenge for the next 3, 4, 5 years, but very quickly, you know, I am a winemaker. I am somebody who belongs to the land. I came back to my house, to my region, and I took my motocross, a Kawasaki 250, and with my motocross, I discovered the whole thing, and it was big, unbelievable. Starting by 600 feet of altitude and go up to 3,400 feet of altitude? Come on. Unbelievable. And that was not only in EMEA. It took me years and years to discover everything, to decide what part of land, what part, what type of microclimate. Because in EMEA, it's something really very challenging. There are 17 villages. There are about more than 24 small plateaus between mountains. All those mountains create differentiations on the soil. So we have all the type of the soils, rocky soils, calcareous soils, sandy soils. And another thing, very important, it was the microclimate. Why in Peloponnese do we speak about mountains? I will tell you why. Peloponnese, it's south. South must be higher temperatures. When you go to have something near to the top of the mountain, when I see the top of a mountain because of the cooler climate, I say, this is the refrigerator to my land, you know, of my land. Because all these cool, beautiful, colder temperatures goes down, and that makes very nice conditions for making vineyards and having grapes. That's one thing. The other thing, it is Peloponnese, mind you, it's like an island. It is untouched by the ocean, untouched by seawater. And every day, there is a lot from every direction. There's winds coming from the sea to the mainland. Those winds go through the mountains and through the mountains, they accelerate themselves because of the phenomenon Bernoulli. And like that, we have windy conditions. Windy conditions means no humidity. No humidity means no pesticides. No pesticides means healthy grapes. What else? That's fantastic, you see. To discover all that, understand all that, it took me a lot of time. I do this job within EMEA 30 years. And now I start, you know, because now I have the whole thing to me. Believe me or not, when I started to do my first wine there in the garage of my father, because that was my first winery with 2-3 wine barrels and renting facilities, renting vineyards all over. When I started to do that, I had not confiance in the Ayurvedic grape. I didn't know. So I put a 20% of Cabernet Sauvignon just for give to the wine a guarantee of life. But that was the first ever never blend in Greece between a local variety and a cosmopolitan variety. And that was a school after that. Everybody now does that. So that works. But of course, in meantime, I took the challenge to understand better the Ayurvedico and the to know exactly what Ayurvedico from where and what, you know, what village and what plateau or side, it's the better. So now we have beautiful vineyards all over, and we can do a lot of, you know, we will present new things.
Nemea is in the Peloponnese, which is an island, which is where Sparta is. It's off and to the south of Athens. And where you went is in the south of the Peloponnese in Nemea, which is an area that's well known for red wine. But there wasn't a lot going on in terms of industry for wine in the 80s.
In the 80s, it was like the cooperativa and a lot of bulk wine and a lot of wine making for the big guys of Greece. And no values, you know, it was everything and nothing, you know. As many people describe us like pioneers, we started to create our thing. And that was an excellent example, because other people saw that and the other people jumped to that. When I started to do my first winery, my personal facilities at Gymno, at Nemea, it was 1996, and it was the first
like licensed winery.
Yeah, exactly. It was like a fire after that, a fire who brought a lot of wineries into and started to work with the grapes and the vineyards. And believe it or not, all these beautiful wineries, there are beautiful wineries, because all these wineries from 80s to 90s and after, they are modern. They have high techniques and high materials, machinery and everything. And that was a good gift for the next generation. But of course, there was something difficult, which is the difficult part. It was the vine growers. And it was how to, you know, to adopt new systems, how to understand the agroecological, how to change or not the cultivations. Do we have clones, irrigation? What about irrigation? We need or we not? We don't. There's a big, big, big amount of problems and a lot of the agroecological grape variety has viruses, and we have to clean up everything and to remake things. That's problems, but that's challenge too, you see. And I can see that it takes a lot of time to understand. And now a lot of young guys, younger than me, they start to create new vineyards and understand how to do yields. It's something very important, you know. When there is irrigation, maybe yields will go high very quickly, and everybody knows that that's not a good wine.
So the native grape variety in red in that area in Nemea is Agiarticó, as you said. And one of your real innovations was that you blended in some Cabernet into one of your Agiarticó, about 20% Cab. That became Megas Anis, and that became a big success. And it really broke open some international markets.
Right, right. Megas Anis, it was, as I told you, my first production. 6,000 bottles was my first production. And in the meantime, without knowing what I did, I discovered that also Megas Anis, it was my passport to the exports, you know. Because at the time, Greek wine was a synonym to Retsina. And Greek wine has synonym to very bad image. As I started to be in my booths and, you know, in expositions all over the world, people look at my wines and said, "What? Do you make wine in Greece, really? You make Retsina, guys." I was furious. And then starting to say that this is an Agiarticó, which was really very difficult to pronounce, difficult to understand. And what it is, the Agiarticó, it seems like what? It is like, but I had the magical word that was Agiarticó and Cabernet Sauvignon. People was like, "What? Cabernet Sauvignon? Let's try that." And after that, "Oh, this is right. This is very nice. It's very, you know, elegant." And what it is, the other Agiarticó, and like that, we started to open the doors of the international market with this wine, with Megacinus. It is not only about Greek wine, it's about world wine. I mean, for people like me knew the wine on the 70s and 80s, it was a totally different thing than what it is today. Today you have a lot of wineries, a lot of wines, a lot of styles, a lot of... it's unbelievable. There is everything. There is... I don't know if it is everything in discipline or not. I don't know what it is discipline to the wine. But first of all, it's business. And business started from the United States. You know, when the United States started to sell wine, it was, I remember that, it was like 80s. And the wine, when it's business in the United States and liquor business and things like that and alcohol business, must be quick and must have consumption. The wine set was like 15 to 16 degrees of alcohol, full of color and the big reds from California, you know. And of course, it was very easy to spend the night with a glass of wine. Many, many changes came from then. Now the wines everybody likes. Lighter wines, everybody likes, you know, the Pinot Noir and I don't know what, and it changed a lot, a lot, a lot, a lot. I have to say that people became more educated about the wine, and of course, also the guys, the people, the business guys, the salesmen, everybody, they are educated. And that's very important, because... if you are somebody who sells wines and you have somebody who wants to pick a bottle, you have to understand what is style, what you like, and then to give to you the right selection. So this changed a lot of things. And of course now everybody looks for 100% Ayurvedico from there or there or there, from the best vineyards. And of course, that's a success.
You also make a couple of 100% Ayurvedico. So how do you find that they differ?
Okay, let's speak a little bit about the Ayurvedico. Ayurvedico normally, it is, thin skins. And thin skins, it's not very nice for having structure. So I started to see a little bit having all this experience I had about the Pinot Noir. I like a Pinot Noir. So I try to give a little bit of massage on the skin, having the Ayurvedico plantations to some vineyards in which there are big differences between day and night, and wind also, it's a massage to the grapes, you know. And we saw that the skins became thicker. That was a very nice technique. It took time. I'm speaking like that, but it was like 15 years to understand that. And then another thing, it is, may I take some beautiful tannins from the seeds? And we started to think about that and to work on that. So our Ayurvedicos, it's always based on, you know, on techniques in which, for example, we do delestage. Delestage, why? Just to take some beautiful things from the seeds, but of course, seeds and grapes and skins and pulps must be really very well ripe. If there is this ripeness, then the Ayurvedico becomes so nice because you can take all this stuff. Ayurvedico has the aromas of every small red fruit existing in the world. You have all these kind of berries. All these berries and cherries, Ayurvedico loves cherries, and the liqueur de cerise also on the Ayurvedicos. And you have also a very characteristic violet on the nose, and maybe some carnation flower. That's Ayurvedico on the nose. And the palate, it is smooth, very nice tannins. Tannins can be, they are easy to be drinking now, but also 20 years later. And the whole thing is to have the right yields. And that's something very important. So now we know about yields, we know about extractions, we know about techniques, and of course we do some aggregate because we have a lot of different wines, but we do St. George, which is translation of aggregatico, years and years and years now, which is for us, it is all I described. You have everything. It is a very gentle and very elegant. Of course, in our winery also, there is this philosophy of winemaking, which is we don't care about colors. We don't care about a lot of things, which is only technicity. We care about ripe fruits, nice fruits, and elegant wines. And elegance is, for us, something very important. The other extreme aggregatico we have is the Grand Cuvée. Grand Cuvée comes from high, from Aspergillus, more than 3,000 feet of altitude. Up there, it's cold. And we have kind of maturation over the second week of October, when we finish everything in the second week of September. So up there, because of the very, very cold climate, all these fruits, it's like to have your fruits in your refrigerator. It is not red to black, it's green to red. And that's something very important. And of course, acidity. Oh, wire acidity, which is so nice to have for this kind of red wines. You can also have a fish with an aggregatico like that. And terroir, a unique terroir of deep red soil, which that means, you know, a lot of minerals and that, some volcanic items. And I'm going to have a walk in the vineyard, and the vineyard smells like copper coins. That's also fantastic. We do big skin contacts when we have a good ripeness. Contacts like 20, 25, 30 days. And suddenly after the press of the grapes, we go quickly. And our barrels, wood, in which we have the malolactic. And then surely for the next year, which is also very nice because aggregatico loves to be surely. It's very well protected. And it gets a lot of beautiful, you know, structure from that.
So basically what you found was that if you put the plantings in a windier area, you got thicker skins, which helped you with both tannins and with color. And you also found that if you put the plantings higher up, you maintained acidity for a grape variety that can have a straightforward fruit in youth. And so you wanted more zip. And you found that by avoiding oxidation during the winemaking process, you could preserve fruit, and that a lesy character gave you more complex wine. So it's a combination of where you decided to plant, how you decided to grow it, and then what you did in the winery after.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, another factor, I told it, is yields. Yields, it's unbelievable. In our magazines, even if we have yields like 30 hectare, and other vineyards, they are like 50, and other like 100 hectare. It is a lot of different yields. And this is another obscure thing. It is irrigation. Yes, irrigation, yes or not? And how much? That's something, because some days in Greece there is some summers really, really, really hot, and the vineyards suffered, and it's not good for them. Of course, we calculate the stress and everything in the vineyard to have the best, and we know that this stress and vineyard give nice wines, but sometimes it is too much. So if there is possibility to have some irrigations, we do. But some excellent vineyards existing in on the mountains, it's not possible to have water for that. Others in the plateaus, it's easy to have water, and maybe there we have a lot of water. It is something very important to all those factors you mentioned to have the right decision for yields. Yields is very important for the aggregatico. We know the low yields, it is fantastic wine. And after the 50, it is a little bit scary what kind of wine will be. Of course, Ayurhidka is very famous also to produce everyday wine, you know, and rosé wine and a lot of things, a lot of different wines and styles. And of course, all these, you know, there are a market for that. But I'm speaking always from high-end Ayurhidka and how we think to be the Ayurhidka. And another factor, it is to clean Ayurhidka from the viruses and to replanting really clean Ayurhidka, which is also a very big challenge.
So when Yanis Paraskevlopoulos was here, who also makes wine in EMEA, he said it was quite difficult to convince the growers to lower yields because they weren't into it. So did you have a lot of conversations that were a little bit difficult with people who didn't want to lower yields? Or?
Look, everything is easy to put in the table because everything costs money. If money is enough, then people decide to go lower and to give you other kind of rates. If not, it's a problem. You see? That's one thing. Of course, the one I'm speaking about, the Ayurhidka, I'm speaking about my Ayurhidka's vineyards and what I'm doing with my vineyard. But if you ask me if I use all those vineyards, I use for other wines. There's a beautiful team with me, and we try to do our best.
Kostas Bakasiedis was here, and he spoke about Ayurhidka, and he said that all of it's virused and that it's been a slow process to get it cleaned. When you get clones that are clean for Ayurhidka and you plant them, what different characteristics occur?
We don't know. All we know it is that it's a nice challenge coming. Just to restart planting new clones, clean clones and everything, you know. And of course, Kostas Bakasiedis did a lot of work about that. And I have to thank him. And speaking from the next generation, that will be something very important.
One of the things that you did was really identify different characteristics of different terroirs within Nemea. And there are 17 different zones of Nemea for wine growing. And so what are those and how do they differ?
I can tell you about mine. We know that Gymno zone, our vineyards at Gymno, which is totally different than the profile of soil. There's no soil, there's only rocks. It's my rock and roll wines there, vineyards there. This environment, this terroir, give to us elegance. That's it. It's elegance, balance between the fruit, the alcohol, and the component. If we go to Kuti, it's another type because we have calcareous soils, and it is affected by the sea winds over there, and the style it's darker, not alcoholic, but more rich if you want, less acidic, but really excellent. It's a vineyard to do big and great wines. And if you go to Daphne, which is another place we have vineyards, it is a little bit higher, and we have a lot of types there of soils, but there is no irrigation, and because of that, you have a low yield, and again, concentration, color, very nice grapes to do big wines. And then we go up to Aspropyrgos, and oh, that's the extreme, and I love extreme. And pH like 3.1, very high acidities and crispness and skins and wines with a lot of sparkling acidity, red wines. I love them. And we have some vineyards at Malandreni, which is the lower part. It is like 600 feet of altitude. And there it's another style. It's a more alcoholic, but still with less fruity, but still with a lot of nice concentration and very nice tannins, those wines.
As you indicated before, most people blend a lot of these regions together into their Nemea red.
Yeah. And it is, you know, something, this is inspiration for me. It is like to imagine a guy walk with just one variety. It's a problem. But imagine a guy who works with one variety in 17 different places and having, I don't know how many different profiles. That's inspiration. Every year to say, oh, this year, this is very nice, the other is destroyed, but there it is excellent, and let's do that, and let's do that. You know, I had some lessons of Courtier when I was in Beaujolais. Courtier is the guy who knows exactly all the vineyards, and he takes all the different wines, and he does blends, and suddenly the wine becomes fantastic. That's something like that. All this possibility.
One of the things I've noticed is that Assyrtiko planted in northern Greece tastes wildly different than any Assyrtiko I've had from Santorini. So obviously there are differences in Santorini, but the difference is much bigger when you get off the island. And so in terms of Nemea for Agiertiko, there are differences that you just explained, but is it much different than the Agiertiko grown further to the north in Greece?
You know, 90s, it was very fashionable, the Agiertiko, and many winemakers, vine growers, they took some and planted all over Greece. Very few of them, they are successful. Very few of them. And, of course, the same, because I'm a Muscofilaro guy too. And the same goes with the Muscofilaro. And I can tell you the Muscofilaro, nothing. It is not possible to plant this plant outside of its land. Unbelievable. The Agiertiko, of course, but Agiertiko, it's a fragile. It's a grape variety who can be destroyed at the last moment. With just two, three rains at the last moment, can be destroyed. So, because of the thin skins. So, it is not for everybody. And, of course, to be there, 5,000 years? You know that in our area, it is an area with a lot of history. The Hercules, there is the temple of Zeus and everything, Mykines and everything. So there's a lot of archaeologists who does excavations. And they found seeds, you know, seeds of grapes. And they could calculate that 5,000 years before, this place had vineyards and wine. Yeah, the Agiertiko, it is, I think, it is just for Nemea.
After a word from our sponsor, we'll arrive at a big reveal, a secret to George's work with Agiertiko.
I see. So you consider that a key?
It is.
That and more, right after a short message.
It's not enough to make great wine. You also have to reach the consumer that appreciates that wine. And that's where Offset is an incredible asset. Offset is an independent brand design and commerce technology company that connects with wineries on a human level to help them connect with consumers on a human level. Offset is based in wine country and staffed by creative strategists and technologists who are superb at helping create and evolve wine brands through visual identity and package design, developing the look, feel, and tone of your web content, as well as building beautiful and effective websites powered by their proprietary e-commerce platform, Offset Commerce. That's why leaders like Frog's Leap, Grace Family Vineyards, and Rain Winery already rely on Offset. Reach out to the brilliant team at Offset at offsetpartners.com. That's OFFSET. Partners with an S .com. Offset is focused on the wine industry and can embrace the nuanced needs of your wine brand.
Working with Agiertiko, like, do people use whole cluster? Do people use stems?
The most, and I'm doing that also, it is to de-steam. If you have time and to wait, you can also do the whole clusters. Whole clusters give some, of course, some structure, but the very first years, it is too green for the Agiertiko. It's not possible to have something what we call normal, because I like a normal wine too.
And you also ferment in stainless steel.
Yeah, we ferment in stainless steel. I belong to the generation which really did everything, and I will do everything. So stainless steel for us, it was something clean and nice and working with that. And the last year we started to work a little bit with the cement and some amphoras just to show what it is and show styles and things like that. Of course, stainless steel, it is the 97% of my facilities.
And Aguirre-Tico, is that something where you have to be careful about the press wine?
The Aguirre-Tico, you have to don't care about press. You know, you take what you take, and then presses, it's not, I personally avoid presses. We know that the best of the best, it is everything free runtries. I'm doing to all my reds like that, yeah.
Because I can see in the texture that that's probably true. You don't find the harshness that you might find otherwise.
Aguirre-Tico means style in my world of Aguirre-Ticos. It is nice tannin, round wines. You know, when you have a lot of tannins, because we did that also. All the guys, you know, in the Aguirre-Tico in the 90s and later, we did big extractions, big things. To get, you know, the big red wine. And all of us, we became gentle with the Aguirre-Tico buck. Personally, I'm persuaded that, you know, it is better with the Aguirre-Tico to do just elegant wines and not more than that.
I also feel like there's been some good quality cooperage with your wines. I can't imagine that there would have been high-quality cooperage frequently used in Nemea in the 80s when you got there.
Yeah, you know, when we started, we did everything. I knew nothing. I know nothing. I had to discover everything. Let's bring here everything. So I brought the different sources of oak existing in Europe. I brought from Russian Caucasus oak. I brought from Slovenia. I brought from France, of course, from the north of Italy and some from Switzerland. And of course, all these beautiful different forests of France. Okay, I can tell you that Aguirre-Tico is good with what we call the central massif of France, which is the Allier and Nevers. If you do a Limousin or a transit, the Aguirre-Tico, you can destroy it because the Aguirre-Tico is so fragile. So, when we found what type of how good it is for using, then we started to see how to avoid all this attack from the wood to the Aguirre-Tico. And we went further, and we discovered that to have a beautiful barrels, beautiful wood, you have to give to them a lot of time to be drained. So we buy wood, no barrel. And all the staves stayed out to be drained for 4 years. 4 years later, there is no lignins, there are no problems, and the barrels can accept this beautiful Aguirre-Tico and respect the Aguirre-Tico, because in our winery, we have more than 1,000 barrels, and we detest to smell good in our wines. The Aguirre-Tico in Grand Cuvée stays 12 months in the oak. The Megasil stays like 20, 22, 24, depends. We rock like 6 months. And then when everything gets ready, we go to the bottle, and then we wait a little bit, 2 years, 3 years later, start. Because Aguirre-Tico is fragile. Don't like the oxidation very quickly.
As a grape variety, is Aguirre-Tico sensitive to oxidation in the winery?
I avoid oxidation in the winery.
Is it hard to avoid it?
The presence of the lees and on our barrels, it's a very beautiful protection to the fruit of the Aguirre-Tico. First of all, when we start, after the malolactic fermentation, we take out all the wine and we take separately the lees. And then we bring lees from the last year, we have in barrels, and we put together. And we start to stir for a month, just lees, to give to them, to diminuate the power of reduction. And then we re-put the lees in the barrels. And then we stay in the list 6 months. And then we redo this thing after 6 months. And then all this, it is to have a really very, very fine lees, a beautiful amount of them, because lees, you know, it's about autolysis, it's about dead cells of yeast, and those dead cells of yeast give a lot of protection on the fruit, as you know, and the wine become fatter. But it is a lot of work, a lot of work. It is a technique I learned a lot in Burgundy. And it is a technique come from the whites.
Oh, interesting. Are they white wine lees or are they red wine lees?
No. Red wine.
I see. So you consider that a key, the lees contact?
It is. It is one of the keys, of course. There is that. I always say that, you know, the big difference from something to something else, it's just the small details, but all together. Huh?
And what about the aromas of Aguiertico? How does it change over time in the bottle?
Sometimes, to me, Aguiertico starts like Bordeaux and going to, after years, like Burgundy's. It is so fine, so clean and clear, without a lot of color. It's an adorable wine to have 20 years later. So what you can see, it is an evolution of the aromas. Of course, all the primary aromas of the red fruits become very different, you know, very like plums and like more dark aromas.
That's interesting, because I was going to ask you what other grape variety you would compare it to. You know, sometimes people say Merlot or sometimes...
Yeah. Because of the different styles existing in the vineyards of the Aguiertico, it's also a tricky question, you know, because there's people, they say that this is like a Sangiovese. There are people, they say, oh, this is very Pinot-like. There are people, they say, oh, this is very Bordeaux style. Aguiertico is Aguiertico. It's what it is. Depends from where it comes. And that's all.
You make, as you said, the Grand Cuvée, which is 100% Aguiertico, and then you make the Mega Sense, which is the blend with the Cabernet. And you've done verticals of those going back quite a ways. So as they age, what do you see as the difference between those two wines?
Yeah, they both age very well. From the Grand Cuvée, I had some extreme vintages. 2004, for example. It was a vintage. It was such a cold year. It was a vintage. When the grapes arrived to the winery, it was more than 12 grams per liter, the acidity. It took for us 2 years to make a malolactic fermentation and to have a diminution of the acidity. And when we finish and we put the wine in the bottles, the wine was undrinkable. Then we put the wine in the cellar. And 2014, some 10 years later, we released the wine, and the wine was just marvelous. You see what I mean? That's extreme. That's extreme.
Tasting your wines, the aging curve, you know, you can do 20 years, seems like, in a bottle. Does that seem fair to you?
Yeah. Our Grand Cuvées, Mega Sinos for sure, Grand Cuvées, and the Sinoros, we have another, it's another wine we do, it's another blend with Cabernet Franc, Merlot, and the Aguiertico in between of them. Yes, we have, you know, people ask me how this wine aged, and this question was to me some 20 years before. And I said that I don't know. I have to spend my life with the wine to understand how it is aged. So if you ask me about my last 30 years, I can tell you that my magazine is the super. You can open in 1988, for example. I had one 2 months ago. It is super. So I'm very glad with that. And for me, it was the challenge of my life.
And interestingly, you make a Solera of Megasinus.
You know, for many, many years, it was like, for whom we make a Megasinus. We make a Megasinus for some guys, they have to drink it the next week. Or for some guys to put in the cellar and having that 20 years later. No, there's no answer. There's no answer. We know how our wine is 20 years later, but there is people drink it just the next day. Huh? And so, speaking a lot about that, and having this day Mr. Konstantinos Lazarakis with us, and actually, it's a great idea of him. He told us, okay, guys, let's do a Solera, which having a lot of layers of old vintages and must show quickly. You have not to wait a lot with a Solera. It's what it is. We create a nice barrel of 1,000 liters. So every year until now, we take out the 40% from this barrel to bottle. That's like 500 bottles. And we put the 40% of the new vintage, the upcoming vintage of the Megacinos. Attention, Megacinos, it's a wine we do from two different varieties. It's a wine we vinify differently, and we blending at the last time. So when we blend the Megacinos, waiting in our tanks for about a month to be very well homogenized, then we take an amount from that, which is already in the barrel, to go in another barrel. So it's a double barrel. The wine is really ready to be bottled. So this wine go to make our Solera. And every 10 years, we split our Solera to two new Soleras. And it is doing all that protocol of 40%, la, 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 la. And it is a wine that has a lot of beauty because of all those layers of old vintages. When I have a glass of that wine, I spend at least a half hour to smell it. Because it's, to me, it gives to the possibility to some vintages to show better and other to hide. And you know, it's a meditation wine.
So what's been the key to growing Cabernet Sauvignon there?
There's no significant thing. Yeah, absolutely. Of course, thinking now, 30 years later, if I start and restart, that was only Greek varieties, 100% Greek varieties. But there is a lot of local consumption, and there is a lot of tourists coming to Greece. And, you know, believe it or not, a lot of tourists, they are in Greece. They love to be at their pool and having a glass of Chardonnay.
Because sometimes what I've heard is that the international grape varieties sell more in Greece, where Greeks want something that is more cosmopolitan, but then the export markets are interested more in the indigenous.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Of course, you have Cabernet Sauvignon from all over the world and whatever. But believe me or not, I don't believe it. To me, it's a dream. We sell Chardonnay in the United States. Come on. Greek Chardonnay in the United States. But, you know, that's market. But people look, and especially, you know, okay, United States, it's an open market. It is everything. We have the best wines all over the world existing here in New York, for example. But if you go to Europe, and for example, you go to France, and you say that there's a little bit of Cabernet Sauvignon, they say, what? It's not possible to be accepted. But if you say that it's 100% Ayurvedico, Mavro Tragano, what else? That's very, very well accepted. And of course, that's right. For the future, what we do, it is, yes, we love to reschedule our portfolio and be back to our native varieties, of course. And we have a beautiful vineyard having saved some old varieties from Peloponnese. We work on them. We have a beautiful one, which is the Mavrosti for Argus. We work with that the last 8 years. I think that it's a singing wine. We will love to see that in the future.
And that's a red wine?
It's a red wine.
Is that a full-bodied red wine? Or
Mavrosti for means Mavro black and Stifo sour. And it is like that. We started to make a red wine. It was undrinkable. A lot of tannins, unbelievable. And then I said, okay, let's do something like a Ricciotto or like a Amarone. And believe it or not, we have a wine full of body. Unbelievable red color and very nice tannins and beautiful sugars because we started to do because we didn't know all the different styles of winemaking to make our red sweet wine. So we started to dry our grapes under the sun, to dry the grapes under the shade, dry in special rooms for that, to create, to make a wine like a port. So every year we do something different. And now we know that the best style is the style we created the last 2 years, which is almost Recioto style.
Oh, interesting. And then you also make Muscofila, right?
Oh, yeah, that's my other love. I love Muscofila. I feel just grateful to have this variety in the central of Peloponnese. It is a cold area, a plateau, magical at about 2,200 feet of altitude, homogenized plateau. You have not, it's not like the man. There's typicity. You have every Muscofila existing there, and you understand that's it, the Muscofila. Muscofila grape variety, it's famous for the aromatics. So, for, you know, white flower and rose petals and violet a little bit, just a bit of mint. And of course, citrusy, you know, some sweet lemon. Okay, normally if you smell a glass of Muscofila, you feel that you will have an almost sweet wine, you know. But no, Muscofila has an unbelievable acidity and freshness. It is a refreshing wine. You know, in the afternoon of a beautiful summer day, you know, very well chilled, it's fantastic for having that with fruits like that, with seafood. It's our companion. And of course, Muscofila, it is something which, because of that, it is very acceptable from the international markets. People like to have something like that. It's crisp, it's aromatic, it is what it is. Muscofila, it is famous to have like white wine, some rosé, but very, very light rosé also. And yes, I started in 1989 with the Muscofila, and I create without knowing my first gray wine. It was my first harvest winemaking, so we had some strikes of electricity. So the electricity, and suddenly my first night of my first vintage of my first winemaking, I was out of electricity. And I was furious, unbelievable. And then the grapes stayed in the press, some of them in their casks, you know. And next day, when the electricity was back, we just pressed, and we had a white and wine with a little bit of color, but an unbelievable wine. What aromatics was those? Unbelievable. We knew by that we need a little bit of skin color. What we do now, it is to bring our beautiful Muscofila and put in the refrigerator for 24 hours and take them very cold and then press them, put in the press. And then in the press, what we do, it is we have without any movement of the press, we just fill the press and then we wait for about 2, 3, 4 hours. It depends. It depends from the color, from the maturity and everything. And then we open the press and we take just the free running juice, which is like a 50 to 54%. And this is white. And we love that stuff. We do low temperatures fermentations, you know, easy to do. And very quickly, bottling some January, February, very quickly. The wine, it is very nice to have fresh, 2, 3 years, and that's all.
And you work with a biotype of Muscofila where it's a little darker color on the grape.
Oh, yes. If you walk in the vineyard, and you see the Muscovado grapes, you will see a lot of different colors. And you realize that these are some clones of Muscovado. But nobody had the time to analyze them, to give a typicity to them. So we knew that a kind of that, and I will explain what, it was very different to the others. So all those clones, they are named after the color they have on the grape skins, okay? So we have the Asprofilero for the white Muscovado, the Coquinofilero for the red Muscovado, the Xanthofilero for the blonde Muscovado, many others, and you have the Mavrofilero. The Mavrofilero, we knew that it is something very nice, with nice aromas and nice minerality. So what we did in 2004, we created a vineyard just by choosing from other vineyards just the Mavrofileros. And we created that, you know, in a primary way. But we work a lot and we have a beautiful like 95% of Mavrofilero in this vineyard. And we started. And we did some wine. We called that the Salto. And this wine, we work on wild yeast. Why? Because the wild yeast in white wine give a lot of creaminess. And this Muscovado, it's only 11 to 12 degrees of alcohol and a lot of acid in them. The creaminess is something very important. Gives the wine some, you know, some nice presence. So we try to work on the wild yeast and upon to the first 5 degrees of alcohol, and then we inoculate other yeast from the same vineyard, you see? So we have two inoculations, one wild yeast from the same vineyard and another Saccharomyces from the same vineyard. And there is a saltiness under the tongue to the wine.
How do you see the Greek wine industry showing in 20 years from now?
With a lot of life, you know, a lot of beautiful wines, young guys, and a lot of... for me, Greece is still an El Dorado. I mean, it's still something... I believe that in the terroir, the Greek terroir, there are a lot of values because, you know, land, it is something difficult. Needs real people to work. And this is a little bit tricky, you know. So if people, they take the decision to work with their land, I'm sure that we will have a lot of beautiful wine in Greece.
You mentioned something interesting to me, which was that in light of the financial crisis, there's been many more wineries created in Greece, which is not what I would have assumed, but it's the case by quite a bit in terms of numbers.
Yeah. What happens suddenly? Suddenly there's an economical crisis. And what are you doing? You're going back to your land. That's in Greece. You know, in Greece, by 80s, it was like 70 wineries all over Greece. That's all. And then 2008, it was 500. And from then to now, it is 1,030. Now, why? Because people comes back. Because people find that there's another way to make money and, you know, survive. And people come back to their land. And I love to see families who own grapes, who own vines. And one of their kids will be an enologist and a winemaker. And then the other, I don't know what, marketing or whatever. And all together, try to have a model like 30, 40, 50,000 bottles and make money with that. The better it comes. I believe to that. And I believe that you have to be enough to create style and to give to our country the name a wine country. Because, you know, the number of the wineries is something crucial. It is something very important. We, the... let's say pioneers, this generation, we try to work on that and to give to the new generation better conditions than we had. That's it.
George Skouras found a El Dorado in Greece as a young man, and he thinks it's still available. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much, Levy.
George Skouras of the Skouras Winery in Greece.
All Drink to That is hosted and produced by myself, Levy Dalton. Aaron Scala has contributed original pieces. Editorial assistance has been provided by Bill Kimsey. The show music was performed and composed by Rob Moose and Thomas Bartlett. Show artwork by Alicia Tenoyan. T-shirts, sweatshirts, coffee mugs, and so much more, including show stickers, notebooks, and even gift wrap, are available for sale if you check the show website, alldrinktothatpod.com. That's ILLDrinktothatPOD.com, which is the same place you'd go to sign up for our email list or to make one of the crucially important donations that help keep this show operating. You can donate from anywhere using PayPal or Stripe on the show website. Remember to hit subscribe or to follow this show in your favorite podcast app, please. That's super important to see every episode. And thank you for listening.
It is like the famous Syrah and Viognier, you know? The most of the people think that we have to put just the Syrah and Viognier, and that no, it's not that. It's not that at all. Syrah Viognier was like the lees of the Viognier went to the Syrah, and people, after year by the year, they think that the Syrah didn't lose the color. It was much, much better for that. And that comes from the lease. Yeah. The lease, it is something very important.